From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, how dirty could the 2012 presidential race get?
We're going to have a difficult, nasty, very, very rough campaign.
And Michael Dukakis should know a thing or two about negative campaigns. Our cover story, there will be blood, but does negative campaigning actually work? Here's a hint, it does. Also, the time when former Governor Jennifer Granholm channeled her inner Sarah Palin and how a sane adult should speak to a toddler.
You say no, no, no. You don't want to do that. Your face is sad. You don't want to go with mommy right now.
And later, why Americans inadvertently celebrate Napoleon's invasion of Russia on July 4th, the movie actor Anthony Mackie could watch a million times, and legendary TV producer Norman Lear reflects on his career as he gets closer to 90.
I set out to make people laugh.
Plus, the Smashing Pumpkins' Billy Corgan.
As long as we were successful on the next subsequent record that made sense to everybody around us, the minute that stopped working, I was dubbed an idiot and a fool.
That's all in this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. We're going to head to State College, Pennsylvania in just a few moments to get the latest on the Jerry Sandusky conviction, but first to our cover story today. And to get started, we called up John Geer. He teaches political science at Vanderbilt University, and he wrote a book a few years ago called In Defense of Negativity. And that book explains why John Geer believes negative campaigning actually works. So we asked him what he thinks about the coming Obama-Romney showdown.
Well, I think it's very likely to be the most negative race, at least since the advent of television. You have all the money, especially with the super PACs, and that certainly is one ingredient. The second is you have the polarization of the political parties that have grown. The gap has grown further over the last 4 years. And finally, you have both candidates with some flaws, and those flaws will provide grist for the respective attack mills.
And it's already beginning.
Running for governor, Mitt Romney campaigned as a job creator.
I know how jobs are created.
But as a corporate raider, he shipped jobs to China and Mexico.
But after a record 40 straight months of unemployment over 8%, President Obama insists.
The private sector is doing fine.
Now, one of the things John Geer and most people who study presidential campaigns more or less agree on is this, that the nastiest, bloodiest, most negative election in the modern era happened in 1988. George H.W. Bush versus Michael Dukakis.
As a candidate, Michael Dukakis called Boston Harbor an open sewer.
But Bush's administration cut funds to clean up Boston Harbor.
Michael Dukakis has opposed virtually every defense system we developed.
Now, Dukakis initially tried to attack the attack ads.
Never seen anything like it in 25 years of public life, George Bush's negative TV ads.
And by late September 1988, the Bush team ran a now famous ad about a prisoner named Willie Horton who committed a terrible crime while on a weekend prison furlough.
Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
This spot was so blistering, it was so negative and so racially charged that Dukakis says he and his team decided the best response was to ignore it. And that decision may have cost him the presidency.
And if you ask me now why I made that decision, I'm not sure I can tell you. I mean, I thought people were tired of a lot of the polarization that was taking place, even under the Reagan administration, and just basically said, hey, we're not going to respond to those attacks. And it was a terrible mistake. Because by the time I woke up to the fact that a lot of damage had been done, it was almost too late to repair it.
Do you think negative campaigning actually works, then?
There's no question it works. And unanswered, it really works. But you can't do what I did, which is to simply say, hey, I'm not going to pay any attention to it. I'm not going to respond in any way to the attack campaign. If you do that, you're going to be hurt, and you're going to be hurt badly.
And this year, it could make 1988 look pretty tame, with the two parties more polarized than ever and with outside groups able to spend unlimited amounts of money on ads thanks to the Supreme Court decision and Citizens United. Could this election be the most negative ever?
Well, I don't think there's any question it's going to be a difficult, nasty, very, very rough campaign, and there's no reason for it. I'm not suggesting that that we wouldn't have some negative campaigning in this campaign without Citizens United, but I think that it was a terrible thing for the American political system.
That's former Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis. He now teaches at Northeastern and UCLA. But no matter what year, 1988, 2008, even 1908, negative campaigns have been the rule rather than the exception.
Compare this year to something like the John Quincy Adams, Andrew Jackson campaign in the 1820s.
This is Frank Rich. He's a writer at large for New York Magazine.
When attack ads accused Jackson of cockfighting, cannibalism, accused his mother of being a prostitute, his wife being a bigamist. We seem to think the world is always, you know, going to hell in a handbasket and everything's getting worse. But actually, people had an historical memory. They'd see that this was relatively mild, what we have now.
Frank Rich believes that 2012 will not be a departure from history. And in his latest column for the magazine, he argues that victory for either candidate will be achieved by going negative.
I think the Obama campaign is already proving that it's ready to go negative early and often. Their first official ad of the general campaign, the Bain ad attacking Romney.
Bain Capital walked away with a lot of money that they made off of this plant. We view Mitt Romney as a job destroyer.
What was fascinating to me is that there was nothing really new about that ad. It wasn't a particularly startling ad. In 1994, in the campaign with Teddy Kennedy for the Senate, Ted Kennedy ran very similar ads about Bain.
Taking away their dignity.
Basically cut our throats.
I'd like for him to show me where these 10,000 jobs that he's created are.
And by the way, Kennedy won by 17 points in a landslide in that Senate race in Massachusetts. And also, there was nothing really in Obama's anti-Bain, anti-Romney ad that was as vicious or as factually inaccurate as what Gingrich did when he tried to bring Romney down over Bain in the primaries.
Mitt Romney became CEO of Bain Capital the day the company was formed. His mission? To reap massive rewards for himself and his investors.
This is the American culture. If the goal is victory, I'm afraid we can all poo-poo it, we can all complain about it and wish that all of civic discourse was the way it is on, say, NPR. But this is just a part of it. And I would point out to those who've complained about Obama's negative ads already, saying, you know, whatever happened to hope and change, Obama ran a lot of negative ads in 2008. I'm sure many people remember, particularly the one McCain couldn't remember the number of houses he owned.
Well, it's seven. Seven houses. And here's one house America can't afford to let John McCain move into.
So the Obama campaign is schooled in this, and presumably they're going to act upon their expertise, as will the Romney campaign.
Frank, I know you talk about how America can't be, you know, like a PBS roundtable, that it's a lot more hard-nosed than that. But I wonder whether you're wrong about that and whether there is a danger in emphasizing things like Romney's so-called secretive faith or Obama's the attempts to suggest he was raised in Kenya. I mean, those are arguably bad for America if those conversations become louder and more amplified, don't you think?
Yes, of course those conversations are bad for America, but we can't pretend they're not happening. And therefore, the two campaigns are going to have to participate in them to sell their respective candidates. On the other hand, the country has survived it all. You know, we can always feel that everything's going bad at any given moment, but the truth is we have to take a little bit of a longer view and realize this is part of what waxes and wanes in American politics.
New York Magazine's Frank Rich. The political scientist John Geer, who we heard from earlier, he thinks negative campaigning isn't just effective, but that it's actually good for American democracy.
Well, I think it is a good thing. It's at least underappreciated. Democracy requires negativity because when you have two parties that are competing, one's in power, one's out of power, the group out of power has to criticize those in power because they have to tell the American public why they should be replaced, and that requires criticism. So from the broad, small-d democratic point of view, there is no democratic country in the world that doesn't have negativity in it because it's kind of a foundational aspect of such a system.
John, poll after poll shows that most Americans do not like negative ads. They don't like those kinds of campaigns. So why do politicians keep mounting them?
Well, first of all, if you ask the public, and I've been doing some recent research on this, if you ask the public, do they like negative ads, they say no. But if you ask the public, do you want to know if one of the candidates has flip-flopped, if one of the candidates has raised taxes, do you want to know these kinds of things? The answer, yes. That is, they want to know the downsides of candidates. We spend a lot of time worrying about the exaggeration or the misrepresentation on the negative side, but the same thing goes on the positive side. I mean, Mitt Romney is claiming that he balanced four budgets in a row as governor of Massachusetts. That is correct. But it's also true that if you and I were governor, we too would have balanced the budget because it's mandated by the state constitution. So we forget to fill in the other side of the equation, but that's natural to campaigns.
I mean, it may be true technically, but often taken out of context, right? So if you're a member of Congress and you vote for a bill with tons and tons of amendments attached to it, and one of those amendments might be, you know, funding for a tea house in northern Alaska, you could be accused of waste and fraud and abuse and all those things.
Well, that's right. It could be taken out of context. But don't forget that a negative ad is just one part of a conversation. So let's say I air a negative ad against you and I make a claim about this frivolous spending on your part. You can respond to that. And I think that's all to the good, because if they become president, they're going to wake up every morning to a new round of attacks, and they have to be ready to sit behind the big desk if that's what they want.
Looking at this election now, as it's starting to shape up, do you have any sense of how negative it has been so far and where it's headed?
Well, there are some data from the Wesleyan Media Project that suggests it's already been very, very negative, and we're not even until July yet. And it's probably going to get more and more attack-oriented, partly because, you know, Obama does not have a lot to run on, to be honest. And Romney has some, you know, aspects of his record that he has to explain. It'd be really fascinating to see how it all plays out, because the super PACs, yes, they're separate from the candidates and they have all these legal separations, but it doesn't have the same feel as like the 527 groups, which sponsored the Swift Boat ad in 2004, which were much more separate from the candidates. The interesting thing about that ad is that ad aired in 1% of the country. Yet by end of September of 2004, 80% approximately of the American public had heard of the term Swift Boat. What that tells you is that the power of that ad came not from the airing, but from the news media's coverage of it. So to me, the single biggest change in this country is not the rise of negative ads. It's the news media's fascination with negative ads. It really began in 88 with the Bush Dukakis campaign, has continued forward, and actually, I think, changed the incentives of consultants, because now they know that if they air a negative ad, it might get extra attention.
That's John Geer. He teaches at Vanderbilt University. And despite the fact that polls consistently show voters don't like negative campaigning, well, John Geer did a study that found negative ads by a margin of 60% tend to be more accurate and truthful than positive ones. Brace yourself. It's going to be a long, bloody campaign season. Coming up on the program, when actor-turned-politician Fred Thompson played Bill Clinton. We have to hear a little bit of your Bill Clinton impression.
Well, I don't know if I can do that or not. But...
stay with us. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This past week, we found out that the Obama campaign has picked Senator John Kerry as the stand-in for Mitt Romney when the president will practice for debates. Now, being a debate stand-in is actually serious business, so we turned to a couple of people with experience who could give John Kerry some advice. Here's how former Senator Fred Thompson might play Mitt Romney.
You know, the president, after spending almost $1 billion in a stimulus package, has unemployment still over 8% and not getting any better, and 500,000 people fewer are working than when Obama took office, and he's added $5 trillion to the debt, more than all the other presidents put together. So, bingo. You know, what are you going to do with that?
Back in 1996, Fred Thompson played Bill Clinton in mock debates against Senator Bob Dole, who was the Republican nominee.
I went back and reviewed, you know, Clinton's positions on the various issues, things he had used in attack mode against his opponents.
And that's why we've got a country with 10.5 million more jobs and record numbers of new businesses and rising incomes and falling crime rates. And
you know, the president reminds me sometimes of my brother Kenny, who's no longer alive, but Kenny was a great talker. And he used to tell me things that I knew were not quite accurate, so we always had a rule, we divided by six. Now, maybe in your case, maybe just two.
It was a serious business, and I put a lot of effort into it, and I tried to beat him. I tried to beat him down. I think that if you can generate a little bit of hostility in the atmosphere and get your candidate's blood flowing a little bit faster, that's a good thing. I think it's a good thing to have an audience. It's going to make him a little sharper. It's going to make him want to, even in that circumstance, want to do well.
A lot of people, of course, know you as an actor. Did you approach the role of Bill Clinton in an improvisational way, or did you approach it as a politician?
No, totally as a politician. I don't think of trying to adopt mannerisms or look like or sound like the person that you're representing. I guess there is a similarity to acting that I hadn't thought about much. They put you in this makeup, they sit you in a chair before an audience, and then everybody in America practically is watching you for a slip-up, and your goal is to act naturally. Well, nobody can feel very natural under all those circumstances, but it's the difference between regular season and the playoffs.
Obviously, you prepared Senator Dole as best you could. That being said, Senator Thompson, at the time, all the pundits, they overwhelmingly said Bill Clinton won those debates.
Yeah.
Did you feel like, oh man, I didn't do as good of a job as I should have done?
I don't recall feeling that way. you can't put too much responsibility on a debate coach. You can't get past the basics. Bill Clinton is just a good debater.
Before we let you go, we have to hear a little bit of your Bill Clinton impression.
Well, I don't know if I can do that or not, but I'll try a little bit.
Well, Senator Fred Thompson, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
We also called up former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm. She stood in as Sarah Palin 4 years ago to help Joe Biden prepare for the vice presidential debate.
I went back and looked at the debates that she had when she ran for governor of Alaska. I studied what she was saying up to that point. To the extent that I could, I became sort of a paleontologist.
That's interesting. Did you channel Sarah Palin? Did you become her?
No, I totally became her. At least I tried to be. I'm no Tina Fey, but I wore glasses and a red suit and tried to anticipate how she would answer the questions, try to get under his skin so that you could provoke and get him used to being able to respond to difficult questions, and we anticipated almost everything except for perhaps the wink in that debate.
What do you expect? A team of mavericks. Of course, we're not going to agree 100% on everything. And
what specifically do you remember? I mean, was there something that you said during the mock debates that you actually saw happen during the real debates?
Yeah, clearly she was trying to channel John McCain.
I think that's why we need to send the maverick from the Senate and put him in the White House, and I'm happy to join him there.
The whole maverick thing, the ability to be a team of mavericks.
And I've joined this team that is a team of mavericks.
All of those things were things that we had anticipated. It was a tough debate. He had to come across, even though he's a Washington guy and he knows all that stuff, it's a challenging thing for a man debating a woman because you don't want to come across as, beating her up in some way.
Let's listen to a clip. Biden had just said twice, he was talking about the commanding general in Afghanistan. He said that he didn't think a surge in Iraq would work in Afghanistan. Biden did not name the general. It was, at the time, it was General David McKiernan. Here is Palin's response, and she is going to get his name wrong.
Well, first, McClellan did not say definitively that the surge...
Well, our commanding general did say that.
He lets it go, Governor Granholm. He passes it up. Is that something that he was kind of prepped to do?
Yes, absolutely. He was not going to... I mean, obviously that was not intentional on her part, but he was not going to try to appear to condescend in any way. And we tried 20 million different ways to get him to take the bait.
That's former Michigan Governor Jennifer Granholm. She's now the host of The War Room with Jennifer Granholm on Current at 9 p.m. Eastern. Jennifer Granholm, thank you so much.
You betcha.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Pediatrician Harvey Karp has treated thousands of children over the course of his 30-year career. That includes the kids of celebrities like Madonna and Pierce Brosnan. And his popular series of parenting books, The Happiest Baby, are international bestsellers. His latest book is called The Happiest Baby Guide to Great Sleep. And if you're a parent, you know we're really talking about your sleep.
Well, it's the number one complaint parents have. And it isn't that they're being, weak or wussy. I mean, the fact of the matter is, the military uses sleep deprivation to train Navy SEALs to endure torture because it's one of the main triggers for postpartum depression. You get more illnesses. Your immune system is knocked down. Of course, you're irritable and you have more marital stress when that happens. So it has a lot of burden on families beyond the fact that you're tired.
You are best known. Anybody listening to this who has had a child in the last 5 years knows who Harvey Karp is because you probably received one or two or, in my case, five copies of his DVD from friends of mine. The Happiest Baby on the Block, which is basically a method to quiet your kid. The five S's, this is what you're famous for. So for people who don't know what those are, tell me what the five S's are.
So it turns out calming a crying baby is oftentimes as simple as turning on their calming reflex. Mm. That's a reflex all babies are born with. That's a kind of an off switch for crying and an on switch for sleep. And the way you turn that on is by doing these five steps that imitate the womb. It's swaddling, which is snug wrapping. The side or stomach position, never for sleep. The back is the only position for sleep, but it's the worst position for a crying baby. The third is shushing or white noise. The fourth is swinging or rhythmic motion. Mm. And the fifth is sucking. And every kid's a little bit different, but you layer those on. And in the first 3 or 4 months of life, those are like a magic, you know, potion for them.
Do you know how many times I was crouched over with my child on his side going, shh, at 2 a.m? And it's strange because you actually, the way I did it was not as loud as you suggest.
Mm-hmm.
You suggested you do it quite loud.
Well, you do it as loud as they're crying, really.
Yeah.
And the sound of the womb is louder than a vacuum cleaner 24/7.
The idea that you have is that when a baby is born, they enter the fourth trimester.
Right. So in other words, our babies aren't like horses. They can't run the first day of life. They're very immature. It's amazing. By 3 months of age, they're ready to do the most important thing a human being ever does, which is develop social relations. You smile, they smile. You coo, they coo. But they can't do that in the first couple of months. And so we need to recognize that they're evicted from the womb 3 months before they're ready for the world. So even if you hold them 12 hours a day, that's a big cutback from the 24 hours a day they were used to. And this noise thing is an important part of it too, because in the womb, the sound is loud. And so to put them in a quiet room and tiptoe around seems like that's a right idea. Actually, it's sensory deprivation. It drives them crazy. It's a wonder that any of them sleep in a quiet room. And so one of the things that can be a help is to use white noise, because what happens is that you think while you're sleeping. The white noise literally competes with your thinking, certainly competes with other sounds on the street, trucks and planes and things like that that can disturb you. But it even competes with your own thinking. So it helps kids and adults, for that matter, be able to stay in a better level of sleep.
Let's talk about some myths that you want to dispel. One of the myths is never wake a sleeping baby.
Right.
Why would you want to wake a sleeping baby?
Well, the fact of the matter is that one of the things we have to teach babies is how to be able to put themselves to sleep on their own. What you're hoping is that when your little baby wakes up at 3 a.m, if they're not hungry or they're not in pain or something, they have the capability of putting themselves back to sleep. If you always rock and feed your baby until they're in this blissful state, and then you gently put them into the bed, then they've never learned that ability. So there's a technique called wake sleep where you feed your baby. Don't worry if your baby falls asleep in your arms. That's fine. But when you do put the baby in bed, and they're drunk from the milk anyway at that point, you kind of slide them in bed, swaddled with the white noise playing, and you literally wake them up. They look around for 5 or 10 seconds and fall asleep. And in those 10 seconds, they're learning how to self-soothe.
How has early childhood parenting changed over the course even of your career, you know, let's say over the last 20 or so years in the United States, dramatically?
We've kind of gone through a cycle where parents have gotten very good at doing well in school, doing well in the workplace, and having these more mature kind of methods for dealing with people. Unfortunately, when you take those business methods to work with a toddler, it can lead to conflicts. And so I think that one of the big changes that's occurred is that parents have lost their way in terms of being able to have good relationships with their young kids and have kind of an intuitive approach to how they should speak and what they should expect. What I talk a lot about is how you need to speak to your child in kind of a different language. That toddlers, in an odd sort of a way, are like cavemen. They're uncivilized. Mm. Matter of fact, your job, and you know this, you've got two kids. Mm. A 9-month-old is not born knowing how to say please and thank you and mm-hmm. wait in line and share their toys. Mm-hmm. We have to teach that to our toddlers. But what is one of the biggest mistakes parents make is when their toddler is upset, we tend to speak to them almost like we're like mini psychiatrists.
Right.
The more upset they get, we go, sweetheart, it's okay. It's okay. Calm down. Like we're talking off out of jumping off a bridge or something. And what that feels like when you're very upset is it feels patronizing.
Yes.
Like you don't really understand how I feel. You're just trying to make me stop talking. And so with a very simple change in technique where you use short phrases, repetition, and mirroring a third of their feeling, I call it toddlerese. Hmm. So when your child is upset, it might be something like, you don't like it. You say, no. You don't want to do that. Your face is sad and you don't want to go with mommy right now. And what happens is they start to calm down because they feel acknowledged. And then you say, but honey, we have to go. Daddy's waiting. You know, and then you get to your message. And this isn't magic. It doesn't work 100% of the time. But probably 50% of the time, you can stop a young child's temper tantrums as young as a year of age, because what they're trying to do is just get you to understand what it is they're feeling. And they just want to be acknowledged.
What do you think is the biggest misconception you hear about parenting? Like, what do people think parenting is, maybe before they have a kid or if they don't have a kid, that is just not true?
Well, the biggest misconception, I think, is that you're going to have control in the situation. Mm. We're so used to having control in our lives. And even being pregnant, you kind of have control. You can make choices and do the things you want to do. Once you have a child, suddenly that control is taken away from you. And that's a real shocker for people with young children. You ultimately have to make the decisions, obviously. You're the last resort.
Yeah.
But young children do need respect, and they do need some opportunities to make decisions so that they can grow up and learn how to do that. This idea that you've got all the answers, all the control, you know, that's something that I think is a shock for parents.
That's a renowned pediatrician, Dr. Harvey Karp. He's a fellow at the American Academy of Pediatrics. His new book is called The Happiest Baby Guide to Great Sleep. You could also call it The Happiest Parent Guide to Great Sleep.
Well, hopefully the whole family.
Dr. Karp, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Guy.
Today, on June 24th, 1812, Napoleon's Grand Army began its fateful march into Russia. Now, three very important things came out of that invasion. The first was the eventual downfall of Napoleon. The second, Tolstoy's War and Peace. And the third was this. This is actually one of the most recognizable pieces of music ever made. It's Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture. Now, most of us are familiar with the climactic, cannon-pounding finale that comes about 17 minutes in. We usually hear that on the 4th of July, and we'll fast forward there in a moment. But first, we asked writer and composer Jan Swoffer to explain the story behind the 1812 Overture. Almost 70 years after Napoleon's invasion, the then-Tsar, Alexander II, commissioned Tchaikovsky to write a piece commemorating the event.
Well, this is a piece that is almost cinematic, even though cinema hadn't been invented yet. It's a point-by-point depiction of the story. So at the beginning, you hear this very beautiful hymn. And it represents the point at which the Tsar asked the whole country, when the French were approaching, to pray. And then it goes into the approach of the French. And then you have this sudden cinematic cut. And this represents the people in the villages, the poor peasants trying to absorb what to do, and they're praying. And then the battle music starts up again, and there's an absolute conflagration of Russian tunes against French tunes. It's almost a battle of the bands, literally. The 1812 Overture. There's a kind of defeat of the Marseillaise, the French, and these teeming, whirling strings. And then you hear the triumphant Russian march. With underneath it, a song called God Save the Tsar. Because the whole thing that they said at the time was, we prayed for God to help us, and he did. And that's what everybody knows won the war. Tchaikovsky was not self-critical. He was self-loathing. And he thought the piece was a bunch of junk and completely disavowed it and was just considered it a kind of noisy, patriotic piece that he could do. The thing is that he did things like this very, very well. And the piece is fantastically well scored. It's really beautifully done. There's a kind of Russian genius for orchestration, and from those cellos, divided cellos and violas at the beginning, playing this throaty, profound Russian hymn all the way to the big celebratory quality of the end. And it's really a great piece of work.
Well, here's a question. Why do we hear the song on the 4th of July? This is about Russia defeating Napoleon. Why? What does it have to do with the War of Independence here in the U.S.?
And music that's Russian to the core. You know, it really is. Well, two things. Arthur Fiedler in the 70s, I think 77, started doing it with the Boston Pops, and it was a gigantic success. And after all, it's a piece that it has fireworks built in. So in that sense, it's a natural. And it has sort of enormous patriotic celebratory quality, no matter what it's celebrating. But then, you know, by the time it comes around and the fireworks of the 4th of July, everybody's pretty drunk anyway, and it's a fantastic climax for the evening with this explosion of joy and fireworks and cannons, and, you know, what could be better?
We are all celebrating Napoleon's defeat at the hands of the Russians, and yet it happens on the 4th of July.
Yeah.
It's sort of weird.
Most people don't know that at all.
That's Jan Swofford. He teaches at the Boston Conservatory. Throughout the summer, we're asking actors and writers and directors about the movies they never get tired of, the ones they could watch a million times, including this one from one of the stars of Abraham Lincoln, Vampire Hunter.
My name's Anthony Mackie. I'm an actor. The movie I've seen a million times is Top Gun, directed by Tony Scott, starring Tom Cruise, Val Kilmer, the beautiful Kelly McGillis, and Anthony Edwards. I was about 11 or 12. I was really into airplanes the first time I saw Top Gun, and it was on TV. And all I see are these F-16 Tomcats, like, falling into the frame.
Your vector 090 for bogey.
I was like, this is amazing. I was completely just enthralled by it.
Mustang, this is Maverick. MiG-2 is headed home.
The movie's about a young, hot pilot named Maverick. Maverick and Goose are partners, and Goose is his spotter. He's the guy in the back of the jet that tells him what's going on, but he's also his best friend.
You shake my nerves and you rattle my brain.
You have Val Kilmer, who's Iceman, who's the other hot pilot.
What's your problem, Kazansky? I don't like you because you're dangerous.
There's this scene where he bites at Maverick. And it's the weirdest moment in film history. But it works. When he bites in his face, he's like, oh, that guy is sleazy.
Remember, boys, no points for second place.
They go to an academy called Top Gun, where the Navy invites all of the best pilots so that they can compete and try to win this honor of being the Top Gun.
Top Gun was created to teach ACM, air combat maneuvering, dogfighting.
Cut to music. Heaven on the edge, living on the island. Right? Tom Cruise and Goose goes to a bar and meet this beautiful woman, and they sing a rendition of You've Lost That Loving Feeling a cappella to where the entire bar starts singing to this woman.
You've lost that loving feeling. Oh, that loving feeling. You've lost that loving feeling. Now it's gone, gone, gone. Whoa, whoa, whoa.
Tom Cruise then learns in the next scene that Kelly McGillis is his instructor. So they have this brief love affair. Take my breath away. There's one scene where Tom Cruise goes over to her house and they get in this big fight and he goes out on his motorcycle and she's like,
my review of your flight photos in the past is my honor.
And he's revving his motorcycle.
I can't hear you.
And then he rides off. It's pure drama.
I was afraid that everyone in that tax trailer would see right through me.
and I just don't want anyone to know that I've fallen for it.
I think the older I get, the more corny it gets, because now I just watch it and I laugh at it.
That's actor Anthony Mackie talking about the movie that he could watch a million times, Top Gun. His new film is called Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, and it opened this weekend.
You like that? That's really my ringtone. If you call me, that's what comes on my phone. That's weird, right?
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like me, we had it made. Those were the days.
What a great show. And it wasn't just All in the Family that producer Norman Lear brought into our living rooms, but also classics like Maude, The Jeffersons, Good Times, and Sanford and Son. In the early 1980s, Norman Lear decided to take a break from television, and he started a civil liberties group called People for the American Way. Lear was here in Washington, D.C. this past week to celebrate his upcoming 90th birthday at the Kennedy Center. You look terrific. I cannot believe you're almost 90.
For crying out loud. Anybody wants a picture, just call.
Norman Lear stopped by NPR to talk about his incredible career, his political activism, and his rough childhood in Hartford, Connecticut.
I was a kid of the Depression. I saw my father's brothers go belly up. My father was always belly up because he was very difficult for me to call my father what he was. So I used rascal. But he served time. He was in trouble a lot with the law.
What did he do?
He sold some bonds that, you know, were fake bonds or something. Went to prison for 3 years when I was 9 years old. But I can't overstate how much I loved him. You hear me talk about him lightly because I cannot make him a villain. You know, I loved him.
You were a Jewish kid at a time when...
Still a Jewish
and
kid.
Still are, forgive me. At a time where that was not so easy. I remember reading or hearing an interview you gave where you talked about hearing Father Coughlin on the radio, the infamous sort of Jew baiter.
My father gave me a crystal set.
One of those radios that you
radio,
make,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, you make yourself, and it's a little cat whisker wire that circles a crystal. And I discovered Father Coughlin in bed one afternoon or evening, and suddenly I'm listening to a man condemning one of our great heroes, FDR, in my family, and speaking kindly of the Nazi movement about which we were just learning in Germany, and his dislike of Jews.
Did it scare you?
It scared the hell out of me, because it was the first time I learned that I was, quote, different. And I started to pay a lot more attention to people who were even more different in the eyes of people like Father Coughlin. And I think my political interests and sensitivities started there.
You have mentioned that you modeled probably the most famous character you ever created, one of the most famous characters in American television history, of course, Archie Bunker from All in the Family, that you modeled him after your father.
Mm-hmm.
What was
in some ways.
In some ways.
In some ways. Yeah, my father used to call me the laziest white kid he ever met.
Gloria, you married the laziest white man I ever seen.
All right. It's bad enough you got to make fun of me. You don't have to make it worse by attacking a whole race.
Who's attacking a whole race?
I used to scream at him. How can you put down a whole race of people just to call me lazy? And he would scream louder back at me, "That's not what I'm doing, and you are also the dumbest white kid I ever met."
He also called you meathead, I understand.
Meathead, dead from the neck up.
which of course is what Rob Reiner's character was called by Carol O'Connor, played Archie.
Yeah, he also told my mother to stifle.
Will you stifle yourself?
Will you stifle yourself?
Will you stifle?
So and there was an awful lot of all of that in all the shows.
What did you want to do? What did you set out to do with that program?
I set out to make people laugh, truly to make people laugh. But we approached it seriously. Our writers read 2-3 newspapers a day, paid a lot of attention to their kids and families, came in to talk about everything that was affecting us in our daily lives. And that's where we got our material.
What is it with your generation anyway? You give us 10 years of misery with all the long hair and the dope and the guitars? A spell in the Vietnam War?
Spoil the Vietnam War?
Yes, yes, you made us stop it there before we had a chance to smash him over there. Now we gotta run over there and buy Earl we could have had for nothing.
I'm speaking with the legendary television producer Norman Lear. He is just about to turn 90 years old. He's also celebrating the 30th anniversary of People for the American Way, which is a group that he founded. I want to get to that in a moment, but I want to talk about some of the other programs that you created. One of the really significant programs you created was Good Times, which portrayed a working-class African-American family in the 1970s, centered around Florida and James Evans and their three kids. They lived in a housing project in Chicago, but they were a stable family, a loving family.
You know, I thought if I'd have got that job that we're going to be okay. Instead, we broke.
What was we yesterday?
Broke.
And probably we'll be again tomorrow. But, James, you always see this family through. You can do it.
Yeah, that's my baby.
Did you set out to create an impression of black America that you felt was not being presented to the public at the time?
You know, I don't recall thinking about it with that specificity. As I said earlier, as a kid, when I learned I was different, I was also learning other people were considered far more different. Like black people in America. When Esther and John became very well known as their characters in Good Times, they felt they were representing black people to America, as indeed they were. But they became extremely sensitive to that. And so when I wanted to do an episode about Thelma, who was 16 and very beautiful, the daughter, having to think about boys that wanted to go to bed with her just to talk about the subject, we had terrible fights. And at one point, I found myself saying around the table, look, we can't argue this way about these things anymore. The patina of black life, I'll never know like you people. But I'm a father, I'm an uncle, I'm a brother, I'm a cousin, I'm all the things you are as a human being. And what we got out of that was some better understanding that we're really all the same people.
You left television, full-time production, in the early 1980s, and you started People for the American Way, which is, of course, a liberal organization that represents liberal values and positions. What did you envision it becoming when you started it?
I woke up one morning, and I heard, I think it was Jimmy Swaggart, ask his television congregation to pray for the removal, I put that word in quotes, of a Supreme Court justice. That was like praying for the illness or the death of a Supreme Court justice. And I had no patience to write a film, take a couple of years to do it. So I did a television spot.
Hi. I have a problem. I'm religious. We're a religious family, but that don't mean we see things the same way politically.
A working stiff wound up saying,
now my problem is, I know my boy is as good a Christian as me. My wife, she's better. So maybe there's something wrong when people, even preachers, suggest that other people are good Christians or bad Christians, depending on their political views. That's not the American way.
I paid for that to run on a single station in D.C. There were only three networks at the time. And the three networks ran it on their 7 o'clock news, and People for the American Way was an act of spontaneous combustion. It just grew up around that spot.
You've received death threats?
I've received a lot of death threats, yes.
But
I don't want that to encourage anybody out there.
Okay. But I guess it's all been worth it for you. To be a lightning rod in some ways. I mean, you have been a lightning rod, right?
I never intended to be a lightning rod. Somebody asked me in an interview just the other day, if I had a bumper sticker, what would my bumper sticker be? And I said, just another version of you. And that's what I think we all are. Versions of each other, because we've got to come to the understanding that we are one.
That's Norman Lear. He is, of course, the legendary television writer and producer of such programs as All in the Family, The Jeffersons, Good Times, and Maude. He's also the founder of People for the American Way, a civil liberties advocacy group which is celebrating 30 years, and Norman Lear is about to celebrate his 90th birthday. Norman Lear, thank you so much for coming in, and of course, happy birthday to you.
Thank you. I couldn't have enjoyed this more. Thanks.
And it's time now for music.
Spy on a ring, do you steal just a ring?
It's not a stretch to say that this band, the Smashing Pumpkins, owned alternative rock for a period in the mid-1990s. And for much of that time, their frontman, Billy Corgan, was at the center of it all, for better and for worse. He came off as cantankerous, egotistical, and impossible to work with. By the late 1990s, the original band split up. But Billy Corgan is also widely acknowledged as among his generation's most gifted musicians. He's kept the Smashing Pumpkins going with new band members. Their new record is called Oceana. And nowadays, at age 45, Billy Corgan is a little more reflective, a little less angry, and back to making music that he loves.
If you make something really exciting, sort of like Field of Dreams, they'll show up. You're never sure who's going to show up, but you know somebody will. So you kind of go more into a personal journey of trying to find something that really is thrilling.
When somebody who is a fan of Smashing Pumpkins puts this CD into their CD player or turns it on, the first thing you think of, it's just natural, right? It's instinctive. You say, does this sound like Siamese Dream? Does this sound like Smashing Pumpkins stuff? And some of it to me does and some of it doesn't. And I wonder, when you go in to write a record and to write music, do you think, I've got to make this sound not like Smashing Pumpkins?
I used to think like that. And that was part of the Smashing Pumpkins business model, was to change and evolve and essentially break and destroy what we'd created. Our most popular styles, which were created in, say, 93 and 95, we immediately turned around and broke the mold, which is business suicide. As long as we were successful on the next subsequent record that made sense to everybody around us, the minute that stopped working, I was dubbed an idiot and a fool.
Do you feel that way, that you are seen that way? I mean, you know, you've written records that are, I mean, seminal records. And Rolling Stone called Siamese Dream one of the best records of...
But Rolling Stone also gave Siamese Dream 3 stars when it came out. And they also gave Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, our most successful record, 2.5 stars when it came out, and they've given Oceania 3 stars again. I found it's really hard to get people to line up on where I'm at any given time, but I think that goes to the visionary aspect, which is, if you actually make something that's beyond the time and the culture, people default to, I don't like it. The funny thing about Oceania is the general person on the street seems to really, really like it.
Please allow me to say hello.
I read a recent review of Oceana, and it really struck me, because a critic hailed you as a songwriting giant. That's what he said. Boundary-pushing innovator. But then he wrote, very few musicians get in their own way more often than Billy Corgan. What do you make of that?
I would agree with that. I have gotten in my own way, but I think that speaks to a couple things. One, it speaks to a pathology, which is for the therapists out there to help me get through. But also, I think it speaks to an artistic process. I'm willing, and have always been willing, to play those dramas and personal issues out in public. I've made that part of my mantle. When you deal with rock and roll, you know, it's sort of played itself out. You know, you can't play any faster, you can't play any louder, you can't be any crazier than Iggy Pop or Jim Morrison or, you know, Kurt Cobain. You pick your guy or girl, right? So what ends up happening is it gets kind of staid and safe. Even though it appears to continue to be dangerous and everybody looks dangerous, nobody's really dangerous, and they know that. So when you actually push a button in rock and roll, even if it's your own, you're actually accomplishing something pretty incredible, because that's really all there is left to do, is find those spaces that haven't been trod over.
Is that what you aspire to?
Yes. My compulsion is to be a visionary mystic, and music has been, of course, my most successful form of communication, but I've also communicated through video, poetry, and just being a public pain in the rear. That's part of my function.
I'm speaking with Billy Corgan of the band Smashing Pumpkins. Their new record is called Oceana. Billy, it's amazing your life's journey is amazing, because you grew up outside of a suburb of Chicago in a rough way. I mean, your parents divorced when you were 3 or so, I understand. I mean,
yeah.
And you did not grow up in Ozzy and Harriet-style household by any means. Tell me about how you grew up.
I grew up, you know, lower middle class. Had 3 families, essentially. Step family and then the blood families. All 3 sides of that picture were immigrant class. So I grew up with, you know, let's call it fear-based consciousness. Must work. must save or die. People had been through all sorts of horrible things, particularly the Great Depression. When I was six, I was tested for a 12-year-old reading level. When I was seven, I was tested for savant-level music aptitude, yet I got very little support from my family or even the culture around me, the school culture around me. So I kind of had this, you know, vibrant curiosity and creativity and had nowhere to put it. So I inverted it like many people would. Add to that then abuse, people dying along the way, a special needs brother who I helped to raise. It's a bit like a Dostoevsky novel, the way it all came out.
But clearly you were driven. I mean, you went to Chicago, and you eventually formed what became one of the biggest rock bands in the world.
Yeah, pretty wild. but I think, again, that's the drivenness of somebody who wants to get out. I didn't have an aspirational thing like, oh, someday I want to be Andy Warhol. I thought, let me get the heck out of here.
Today.
Next year, Billy, marks 20 years since the release of Siamese Dream. It was a breakthrough record. You were just 26 when that album came out. What do you remember about that time?
Well, I do remember that our first album had come out and was quite successful at the time. It was the biggest selling independent album ever. And we thought we were doing pretty good. Everyone's patting us on the back. And then suddenly a band called Nirvana comes along and sells a gazillion copies. Then Pearl Jam comes along and sells a gazillion copies. And suddenly this laser eye fixes on us and says, okay, you're next. And I realized, wait a second, I don't have the skill set to do this. I'm not geared for pop music, but I was wise enough to know that that was the game I was in. Intertwined with a 8-month-long suicidal depression, which culminated in me either deciding to jump out a window or commit to the process of the next album. And I wrote two of the most famous songs I ever had. So very crazy, intense time.
What were those songs?
Today and Disarm.
Disarm you with a smile. Cut you like you want me to. Cut that little child.
How did you break out of that?
Well, here's the funny thing about the journey. I wrote these songs from the depths of my, you know, freak out. And next thing you know, I'm making millions of dollars and I'm being hailed as a subgenius. It fed every infantile fantasy that I was important and that I meant something. And suddenly then my family turned around and was patting me on the back and said, wow. I'll give you an example. I'd given my first album to my father, who said something really snide, one sentence, which isn't worth repeating because the context probably wouldn't make much sense, but I took it very hard. So when I finished my second record, he called me and said, can you send me the record? My dad was an incredible musician, so you can imagine I looked up to him. So I sent him the record, and I just held my breath because I thought, okay, here it comes, you know, here comes the hammer. And he called me a week later and he said, this is an incredible record. You've just blown my mind. And he said, I didn't know that this person was inside of you. And I was like, wow.
Do you still think you're going through that now?
You know, I think we all go through little moments where we see things that circle back, certain triggers. But I think I've kind of walked out of the flames of the whole thing. And the funny thing is, I've never cared less about the music business than I do right now, and it's all coming back to me because I just have found something for myself, and I think that's the attracting point. And I've lived long enough in public life to know that it's really, at the end of the day, not even about me. And so that's a different kind of power, too.
That's Smashing Pumpkins founder and frontman Billy Corgan. Their new record is called Oceana. Billy Corgan, thank you so much for joining us. This was a pleasure.
Thank you, Guy. Thank you.
Faithless smile.
For the week ending June 24th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our show was directed by Phil Harrell. Our production staff includes Brent Bachman, Walter Ray Watson, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Amy Held, and Beenish Achman. Michael Tomsic is our intern. Tony Maturi is our senior editor. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 on Saturdays and Sundays. Thanks for tuning in.
Webs catching sail in a tunnel, a ton of tears. Divine purpose catching rain. It's hourly with anyone this night. From the wrath of revelry, am I the only one you see? Does love matter when love's the actor? For what you are after, it's me. From the path of revelry, am I the outlier?